Vaishnav Rinda Ki Jai, Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai, Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Rinda Ki Jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai, Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamai Jumun Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai, Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskatya De Satarane Vande Ham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. January 6, 2023, in New Varshana, Auckland, New Zealand, and we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, text 78 and 79 of chapter 24 in the fourth canto, chanting the song sung by Lord Shiva. So this is the very end of the song. It's a really nice song, isn't it? And any of you have a favorite verse from this song that you can remember? I mean, it could be English. Nobody? He has this really nice, it has all this philosophy, and he also has these really nice descriptions. About the association of devotees, the universe. Should I read my favorite verses from this song? The Lord is super excellently beautiful on account of his open and merciful smile and his sidelong glance upon his devotees. His black hair is curly and his garments waving in the wind appear like flying saffron pollen from lotus flowers. By the way, tomorrow afternoon at the Sunday feast, we'll be doing things from Krishna meditations from the Bhagavatam, and there is described that the sunrise and the sunset are the movements of the Lord's clothing in the sky. His glittering earrings, shining helmet, bangles, garland, ankle bells, waist belt, and various other bodily ornaments combine with conch shell disc, club, and lotus flowers to increase the natural beauty of the Kastuba pearl on his chest. The Lord has shoulders just like a lion's. I really like that one. Upon these shoulders are garlands, necklaces, and epaulets, and all of these are always glittering. Besides these, there is the beauty of the Kastuba mani pearl, and on the dark chest of the Lord there are streaks named Srivatsa, which are signs of the goddess of fortune. These glittering of these streaks excels the beauty of the golden streaks on a gold testing stone. Indeed, such beauty defeats a gold testing stone. Have you ever seen a gold testing stone? If you ever buy gold in India from the little goldsmiths, they have a stone, they'll rub the gold on it and they can tell the purity of the gold. So again, in our meditations from the Bhagavatam that we'll be doing tomorrow afternoon, it will be described how on the Lord's chest is and his heart is Dharma, and on his chest is sweetly spoken truth and the goddess of fortune. That whenever one is following Dharma, one is held to the heart of the Lord. Whenever one speaks truth sweetly, one is held by the Lord, and then one is touching the goddess of fortune on the Lord's chest. The Lord's abdomen is beautiful due to three ripples in the flesh, being so round. His abdomen resembles the leaf of a banyan tree, and when he exhales and inhales, the movements of the ripples appears very, very beautiful. That's actually a nice statement, I'm pretty sure it's in Bhakti Samhita Sindhu, about Lord Balaram, that when he was sleeping, you could see his exhaling and inhaling. And you may know that the end of the Bhagavatam, one of the very last verses in the 12th canto, it says that it's the breathing of korma, the inhalation, exhalation of korma, that causes the tides. So this is a place where any of you who live here on the property can be very aware of the tides. You have that tidal estuary that's going into the property. And that was one nice thing, Hari Priya, when I lived there. I was always very conscious of the tides. And that is the breathing of korma. And as korma's, as the Lord is breathing, his abdomen is moving. And these ripples, these three ripples. So also what we're talking about tomorrow afternoon is that the ocean is the waist of the Lord. And we meditate about how when the waves are moving, it's like seeing these ripples in the Lord's abdomen and his waist. The coils within the navel of the Lord are so deep that it appears that the entire universe sprouted out of it and again wishes to go back. I really like that. And by the way, the sky is the Lord's navel. The lower part of the Lord's waist is dark and covered with yellow garments and a belt bedecked with golden embroidery work. So again, what we'll talk about tomorrow afternoon is how on the Lord's belt are all of the animals in the world. The quadrupeds in the world are on his belt. The working animals are on his nails, by the way. So the horse, the mule, the camel, the elephant are on his nails, but the wild quadrupeds are on his belt. The lower part of the Lord's waist is dark and covered with yellow garments and a belt bedecked with golden embroidery work. His symmetrical lotus feet and the calves, thighs, and joints of his legs are extraordinarily beautiful. Indeed, the Lord's entire body appears to be well built. Kavi Kanapur writes that the Lord's knees are like balls that Cupid is playing with. My dear Lord, your two lotus feet are so beautiful. They appear like two blossoming petals of the lotus flower which grows during the autumn season. Indeed, the nails of your lotus feet emanate such a great effulgence that they immediately dissipate the darkness in the heart of a conditioned soul. So we'll be meditating tomorrow afternoon on how on the Lord's nails, right? I already said, are the working animals, the horses, the mule, the camel, the elephants, there on the Lord's nails. Also, the Lord's nails produce electricity. So anytime you turn on a light or turn on your phone, that's the touch of the Lord's nails. And the Lord's nails also have jewels on them. So all the stones of the world are resting on the nails of the Lord, which I like to think about whenever I see people with painted nails. When people paint their nails to look like emeralds and diamonds. Actually, Krishna's nails are not. Okay, so those are my favorite verses from the song. And what we're reading today is the benedictory verses. So for a lot of the sections of the Bhagavatam, there's a benediction you get. Right, for reading that section. Okay, is 78 on the board? Or we have, yes. Idamya kalya utaya Panjali shradayanvita Srinuyach Chavayan Marcho Mujjate Karma Bandhanai. We have the next one up to it. We'll just chant that. Okay, anyone chant, please? Yes, rising up. Excellent. Pranjali, anybody know what Anjali means? Yes, very good. Like offering, yes, it's this. Okay. And Shraddha? Faith, yeah. Okay. Shrinu? Yeah. Okay. And we have, it's with a cha, but it's that's because of the Sunday rules, and we have shravana again. Shrava is to? Shravana? To hear, yes. Marchio. Like mitchu. Death. Which here means human beings. The death people, basically. The Shastra often calls us the death people. The demigods are the Amara. They're not death people, and the human beings are the death people, the death entities. We don't live very long, in other words. Okay. Karma bandhana? The bondage of action, yes. Okay. Idam. Idam. This prayer. Yaha. A devotee who? Kalye. Early in the morning. Utaya. After getting up from bed. So I guess you can't say these while you're in bed. You have to get up. Pranjali. With folded hands. Shraddhaya. With faith and devotion. Anvitaha. Thus being absorbed. Shunuyat. Personally chants and hears. Shravayat. And gets others to hear. Marchaha. Such a human being. Muchite. Becomes free. Karma bandhanai. From all kinds of actions resulting from fruitive activities. Srila Prabhupada's translation. A devotee who rises early in the morning and with folded hands chants these prayers sung by Lord Shiva and gives facility to others to hear them certainly becomes free from all bondage to fruitive activities. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Mukti or liberation means becoming free from the results of fruitive activities. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10.6, Muktir Hivanyata Rupam. Mukti means giving up all other activities and being situated in one's constitutional position. Swarupena Bhavastitaha. So that's quite distinguished from Brahman, to get your Swarupa. Swarupena Bhavastitaha. Stita means to stay, to be situated, to be stable. In this conditional state, we are entangled by one fruitive activity after another. Karma bandhana means, quote, the bonds of fruitive activity, unquote. As long as one's mind is absorbed in fruitive activities, he has to manufacture plans for happiness. The bhakti yoga process is different, for bhakti yoga means acting according to the order of the supreme authority. When we act under the direction of supreme authority, we do not become entangled by fruitive results. For example, Arjuna fought because the Supreme Personality of God had wanted him to, therefore he was not responsible for the outcome of the fighting. As far as devotional service is concerned, even hearing and chanting is as good as acting with our body, mind, and senses. Actually, hearing and chanting are also activities of the senses. When the senses are utilized for one's own sense gratification, they entangle one in karma, but when they are used for the satisfaction of the Lord, they establish one in bhakti. What's the verse that defines bhakti that Prabhupada's referring to here? There's two verses Sri Rupa Goswami gives to define bhakti. This is the second one. Yes, exactly. Sarvapati Vinumitan Taparatana Nirmala Rishikesha Rishikena Sevanam Bhakti Richita. Alright, and I was asked to finish the chapter. So I'm going to read text 79. Translation. My dear sons of the king, the prayers I have recited to you are meant for pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supersoul. I advise you to recite these prayers, which are as effective as great austerities. In this way, when you are mature, your life will be successful, and you will certainly achieve all your desired objectives without fail. Srila Prabhupada's purport. If we persistently engage in devotional service, certainly all our desires will be fulfilled in due course of time. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the fourth canto, 24th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Chanting the Song Sung by Lord Shiva. Idamya Kalya Utaya Prajanjali Sharanvita Shunyakchavayan Martyo Muchante Karma Bandhanai. A devotee who rises early in the morning and with folded hands chants these prayers sung by Lord Shiva and gives facility to others to hear them, certainly becomes free from all bondage to fruitive activities. I don't remember when I was reading those. Was I folding my hands? I find that interesting, you know, because they're like the Muslims, five times a day prayer. They have very specific physical postures that they go through when they say those prayers. So it's interesting that to get this shrutipala, to get this benediction, you have also, you have to have a certain time. It's got to be when you get up, and then you have to be in the anjali, or anjana sometimes, it's called posture. My dear sons of the king, the prayers I have recited to you are meant for pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supersoul. I advise you to recite these prayers, which are as effective as great austerities. In this way, when you are mature, your life will be successful and you will certainly achieve all your desired objectives without fail. So I have a friend in Vrindavan, Srimati, and she's gradually getting into older and older age and more frail. And she told me, she said, you know, I can't do a lot of austerities anymore, so I was just chanting these prayers. Because there is, as chanting these prayers are as great, as effective as doing great austerities. So what's the purpose of austerity anyway? And what's the best austerity? And then what do you achieve by doing austerity? Right? So basically, everybody has to do some austerity just to live, correct? You really cannot maintain your body unless you do some things that are troublesome. I mean, the word for austerity is what? Tapasya. And tapa, anyone know what tapa means? Can mean like pain or fire. Sometimes Prabhupada translates it as penance. Well, we'll talk about that tomorrow morning, where Krishna says, I'm the penance of the ascetics. So we can't live without austerity. It's just not possible. Whatever we want to achieve, we have to go through some trouble to achieve it. And sometimes you do the austerity before you achieve it. Sometimes the austerity is after you achieve it. Sometimes you have austerity before and after you achieve it. Right? It's like it's kind of an austerity sandwich that you have the pleasure in the middle and the austerities at either end. So austerity is unavoidable, but the real purpose of austerity is not to try to enjoy this world. People will work extremely hard and go through a lot of trouble and a lot of pain and a lot of sacrifice, you know, to have a big house and a big car and go on vacation in New Zealand. I remember one time when I was staying here and I would fly back and forth to Hawaii where my family was living, and I was seeing these people flying from Hawaii to New Zealand. I'm like, why are you leaving Hawaii to go to New Zealand? But people will go through a lot of trouble, but that's not the purpose. The real purpose of austerity should be to give up our attachment to this world, not to enjoy the world. We have to do austerity anyway. It's not an option, well, I'm not going to do any austerity. Is that possible? It's just not possible. Even if you're, you know, ridiculously rich and you have a gazillion servants, then you have to deal with the austerity of dealing with all your gazillion servants. One time I was in Russia at a festival, and we were being, Bhakti Vaibhava Maharaj and myself were being driven to the festival site. So he gets in the front seat and I get in the back seat, and he looks at his servant, he says, where's my bead bag? Oh, Maharaj, I forgot your bead bag. And he goes up to get it. And Maharaj turns around and looks at me and said, Mamila, don't ever have servants. You know, or if you have a gazillion dollars, you have to do the austerity of protecting all your money and maintaining it, worrying about it. And you probably had to do a lot of austerity to get your gazillion dollars. Right? Even if you were born into a rich family, then you did your austerities in another life. So it's not that we're going to, that's not possible. So if I have to do austerities anyway, I might as well figure out what's the best thing to spend my austerities on. Does that make sense? I always like it where Bali Maharaj says to Vamandev, says, you should ask me for something so great that you'll never have to ask anything else from anyone else ever, which meant Bali thought he was God. But what's the best thing? What should I go to trouble for? So the real use of austerities is to let go of our attachment to this world. Prabhupada's saying, as long as the mind is absorbed in fruitive activities. And this means ultimately letting go of thinking I am the enjoyer of the world. That's the source of all of our problems. 100% of our problems come from thinking I am the enjoyer of the world. Is this world particularly enjoyable? You might think so when you're young, but it's not. It's just really not. Again, you have to do all these austerities to get your enjoyment, and then you have to do a lot of austerities as a result of your enjoyment, and your enjoyment isn't even very enjoyable. You go through all that trouble. I remember reading this thing from, I don't know if any of you know, this famous guitarist, Eric Clapton. He was very famous when I was growing up. And he was, you know, super rich and super famous by the time he was like 24. And he said, he looked around and he said, is this all there is? Like, that's it? You know, it isn't even that enjoyable. Our sense enjoyment is very limited, right? We're very rarely in a situation where we're enjoying all of our senses simultaneously. Generally, it's just one or two. And then it's very limited by time and space. It has a beginning and an end. Right? That's what Krishna says. He says this. The devotees don't enjoy, the yogis, they don't enjoy enjoyment that has a beginning and an end. And it gets boring. You know, if you have pizza for breakfast, for lunch, and for dinner, and for breakfast, and for lunch, and for dinner, and for breakfast, and for lunch, and for dinner. And after a while, you're going to say, I don't even want to look at it anymore. And we get satiated. Even something you really enjoy, after a while, you're like, I need a break. And if you keep trying to enjoy something, you'll actually become revolted by it. And then it's all superficial, because we're not the body. We're not the mind. And so any pleasures of the body and the mind, it's, the Shastra compares this to a dream. Or I think in modern society, we could compare this to a film or a book. You know, it's not your enjoyment. You're watching or reading about somebody who's enjoying and you're thinking, oh, I'm actually killing the bad guy and I'm actually getting the beautiful romantic partner, but you're not. You know, the movie's finished and you're in your seat and you're just as broke and lonely as you were when the movie started. You know, it's not really touching you, and all of our material enjoyment is like that. I'm the observer, as Krishna nicely says in both the 5th and the 13th chapter. I'm just watching this and I'm thinking I'm enjoying it by my attachment. And what is this attachment? The attachment is I'm going to enjoy things separately from Krishna. That's the whole beginning and end of the problem. And Krishna's like, you can't enjoy anything separately from me. It just doesn't work. It's just not truth. Now, I want to enjoy something separately from you. Okay, here you can imagine it. You can imagine. You know, the little child says, I don't want to listen to you anymore. I remember my oldest grandson when he was like 6 saying to his father, why do you have to be the daddy? Why can't I be the daddy? You know, and my youngest son, when he was 10, he said, Mata, don't tell me what I do good, don't tell me what I do bad, just don't tell me anything at all. You know, and you can give the kid a little toy car and they can pretend they're driving away from home. Right? But it's not actually going to work. So Krishna says, you know, all right, because eko bahanam yogadadati kaman, he fulfills all of our desires. So if we have this desire that I'm going to try to to enjoy everything on my own, he says, okay, here's a dream for you. The Shastra compares our material life to a dream. Here's a dream where you can imagine this. And so all of our problems come from this, everything. And all of our frustration with our enjoyment in this world comes from this. So what we really want to do is give up this insanity. And just if I actually want to be happy, I have to do it, as Prabhupada would say, through Krishna. As part of Krishna. Now, I mean, even when I say that, there's still a part of me that goes, no! Why do I have to enjoy through Krishna? Why? Why does he get to be the boss? Once I was at a Govinda's restaurant with one devotee, and he was repeating what Prabhupada said, you know, Krishna is a transcendental autocrat. And I could just feel the rebellion in me. I don't like autocrats. I want democracies. This is autocratic. But that's the problem. Surrender to Krishna. I don't want to surrender to anybody. I'm my own person. I decide my own things. And then we're surrendering to illusion. We're surrendering to suffering. We're surrendering to a body. We're surrendering to a mind. Which is all Krishna's energy. So we're surrendering to Krishna anyway. And Krishna's going, you know, you've got to do it anyway. You really can't not do it. It's just not the way things are. And even logically, it doesn't make any sense. Like, if you have a dance performance, and each person is trying to do their own dance, they're going to bump into each other, and they're going to fall off the stage. It's not going to be attractive. And it's not even going to be pleasurable. And even in our rebellion, we want to do things that are part of a greater whole. All the research shows that no one is happy in their work if they're just working for themselves. People will only be happy in their work if they think it has some meaning, it has some purpose beyond themselves. So what austerity is to break this insanity that I can be independent. That is the nature of the false ego. I can be independent. I can be God on my own. I can be the master. I can be the controller. Ishwaraham aham bhogi siddham. I mean, the irony is that we are actually perfect, powerful, and happy as servants. That's the irony. But the false ego is I want to be perfect, powerful, and happy as the master. Okay. So what's the best austerity for doing that? So the austerity is often given in the Shastra and practiced by people in all different religious and spiritual faiths, often involve putting yourself in situations where you're dealing with things to which you would normally be averse, and forcing yourself to be in a situation where you tolerate your aversions. Like being in cold water up to your neck in the winter and being surrounded by fire in the summer. Or we have, like, you know, Jetabharata and Rishabhdev and Maharishi Yudhisthira at the end, you know, where they allow people to insult them and to throw things at them. They don't respond. I once saw this really interesting little video of this guy who was saying that he suffered terribly in life from being oversensitive to being rejected. That anytime anybody would give him any rejection, it would just devastate him psychologically. So what he decided was to expose himself to being rejected. And he decided that he was going to purposely try to be rejected at least 100 times. And so, you know, he'd walk up to, like, strange women on the street and say, "Would you go out with me?" And he'd walk up to strangers and say, "Would you lend me $100? And he said, as he got rejected more and more, he said sometimes people would actually not reject him. Sometimes people would actually agree to whatever. But he said as he got rejected more and more, it became like a game. And he started to enjoy being rejected. And he lost his aversion to it. So that's kind of the essence of what these austerities are all about. You fast. You fast from food. You fast from water. You fast from sleep. Or you wear old clothing. Do you follow? They're all like that. Things that we normally try to counteract. And you tolerate them, and you don't try to counteract them. You intentionally do things that you otherwise would avoid. You wake up early in the morning. You know, when you actually you want to sleep. But you say, no, I'm going to wake up early. But what's the best austerity is the main thing that we want to avoid is facing our foolishness. Of all the things we want to avoid, too cold, too hot, simple food, getting up early, the main thing we're all trying to avoid is facing that we're acting like absolute royal idiots by trying to enjoy the world. None of us want to feel foolish. The main thing we try to avoid is looking foolish to ourselves or others. Am I correct? And that's the main thing that we'll react to very strongly. If anybody even slightly hints that there's something wrong with us, we tend to get very aggressive. We'll get very defensive, or we'll even get very attacking. At any cost, we will avoid facing the fact that we are perfect, wonderful, incredible beings who is embracing illusion and absolutely unnecessarily living a life of suffering. We don't want to see that. I'm already perfect. I already have the qualities of God. I already have the qualities of God. I'm already a genius. I'm already beautiful. I'm already powerful. I'm already effulgent. And I am knowingly, intentionally doing things that cause me to suffer and not access my actual self. Prabhupada always gives the example of being like a rich man's child who's like lying in the gutter. You know, and you're a fool. You got millions of dollars waiting for you in a big mansion and your own boat and your own plane, and you're lying in your vomit in the gutter. So that's the main thing we don't want to face. That's our primary aversion. We will sometimes admit we made a mistake, but we'll very rarely admit that we have ill motives. Yeah, I did that wrong, I'm sorry, but you know I meant well. Or you just didn't understand what I did. I intended to do the right thing. I wanted to do the right thing. You just don't understand me. It's extremely, extremely difficult for us to say, I am intentionally, knowingly doing things that are causing harm to me and to others, even though there's no reason for me to do any of that. That's what we don't want to face. What we also don't want to face is how wonderful Krishna is, because we're in rebellion. When you rebel against somebody, you want to criticize them. Right? If you leave a job, if you quit a job, usually, you'll badmouth the employer. I remember we had this student, high school student, who was doing something against the school rules and against the regulative principles. And we talked to the parents and we said, I'm sorry. First we said to the parents, look, this is what's going on, and this, can you do this and this to take care of it? And they said, our kid's not doing that. And we said, well, we have ample evidence that your kid is doing that, and your kid is admitted to doing that, and all the other kids say your kid is doing that. And I said, that's not really a question anymore at this point. No, our kid's not doing that. And I said, look, you're going to have to, if you're not willing to take the steps for rectification, you're going to have to take your kid out of the school. But we said, we're not going to put on your kid's record that we've expelled your child. We'll give your kid a clean record so they can go on to another school and, you know, have a fresh start. But in return for this favor we're doing you, we're asking that you don't criticize the school. Right. Oh, no, no, we wouldn't do that. So that's the general tendency. Right. Well, why did you take your kid out of the school? Well, it wasn't really academically a good school. And I'm like, oh, thanks a lot. We also tend to criticize people to whom we're in debt, by the way. This is something I also learned from running a school. It really confused me. Like, I found that the parents who were the most critical were often the ones for whom we had done some sort of a favor. Now, there were parents for whom we'd done favors who were grateful, but pretty much all the really difficult, critical ones were all in that category, people we'd done favors for, and I couldn't understand it. And then I realized that when we feel in debt, and if we feel we can't pay back our debt, we feel very uncomfortable around that person. If I owe you $5,000 and I've only got $100 in my bank account, I am going to try not to see you. Uh-oh. I'm going to go out that door. I'm not going to want to be in your presence because I'm going to think as soon as I'm in your presence, well, I better pay you what I owe you. Just seeing you, just thinking about you is going to remind me that I'm in your debt. Or if I've offended you in some way and I'm not willing to actually rectify it, then I'm going to try to avoid you. So austerity is also meant to kind of go, look at him. He's wonderful. Because that's our other side. We want to defend our own ego. I'm right. I'm good. I'm not a fool. I don't do anything evil. But God is at best irrelevant. When I was writing Learn to Read here, so I reviewed all of the top literacy programs from UK, America, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. And in all of them, unless they were produced like by Christian organizations, I found two very interesting things. One interesting thing was that the kids were eating meat in the stories, but no prey animals ever got killed. So like, if a T-Rex was chasing a brontosaurus, the brontosaurus would be safe. If a tiger was chasing a rabbit, the rabbit would be safe. The book would end, and now he is safe. The only prey animals that could be eaten would be insects. And the other thing, and then the kids were eating meat. So it was like the sympathy was for the prey animal, not for the predator. Nobody cared that the tiger cubs were hungry. You know, but there was propounding meat eating. And the other thing was that God was just absent. He was just absent. You know, there might be a story about Diwali and Ramadan and Christmas, but there was no God there. And it was like, I remember one of my God sisters saying to me very soon after I joined the movement, we were out at a mall distributing books and they were playing some music, and she said, this is, we can be happy without God. So, you know, at best, it's God is irrelevant. Life is going on and God is just absent. And at worst, we're criticizing him. He doesn't know what he's doing. Why is there a hurricane? Why is there a tsunami? Why is there, you know, why did this poor little child get murdered? Why did this happen? Why did this happen? He's irrelevant, or he's foolish. Chitraketu's wife says this. She says, you don't know what you're doing. She says, there's supposed to be a law. The children don't die first. And if you say it's all according to karma, then what do we need you for? And if you say we need you, then why are you killing children and breaking the tie of affection? And we'll never want to take care of our children anymore. You're really unintelligent. Or you find most religions in the world have very little information about God. What's God like? I don't know. He's great. Oh, that's great. Great how? So you can go through the motions of being religious without actually having any connection with Krishna. You follow? So austerity is meant for two purposes. The best purposes of austerity is to face the two things we don't want to face. I'm acting like a ridiculous idiot, and Krishna is wonderful. Does this make sense to everybody? These are the two main things we're avoiding. More than it being too cold or too hot, or food we don't like, or cleaning out that closet, or, you know, the main things we're avoiding are facing my false ego and facing the beauty of Krishna. Therefore, the best austerity is to hear about Krishna. That's the best austerity. That's actually a better austerity than going up in a mountain cave and eating only, you know, whatever roots you dig up. Breathing once every 30 days. In fact, sometimes what happens when you do those other kinds of austerities is you just become proud that you're the master of your body and mind. I actually used to do a whole bunch of austerities, and then I was hearing Prabhupada saying in a class that the yogis take pleasure in being the master of their body and mind, and I went, oops. Oops. And then I stopped doing all those austerities. I said, it can lead to the opposite effect. Right? I mean, demons do those sort of austerities too. I can control my senses, and I can control my mind by doing this fasting, doing this extreme physical stuff. But the best austerity is to hear about Krishna. And hearing about Krishna can be wonderful. It cannot feel like an austerity. Did it feel like an austerity when I was saying those verses? Where you're like, oh, this is really austere. Why shouldn't it be quiet? I wanted to read more. I'm like, do I have to go on to the, can I just find more verses like that? And reading about Krishna's form, Krishna's activities, Krishna's devotees, Krishna's qualities, all of Krishna's pastimes, talking about them with others. Majjita magata parnam boryantas prasram katayantas chyam nityam tushanti charamanti chyam. One will find satisfaction and bliss. And then one starts to realize, oh, now I'm actually happy. All the ways in which I tried to be happy in this world just led me to disappointment. And now I'm actually happy. Have we all had this experience? It's like, I'm actually feeling happiness. And I'm feeling real happiness. I'm feeling happiness that isn't getting boring. That isn't, I'm not feeling satiated. Oh, that's enough hearing about Krishna. And it's authentic. I, the soul, am experiencing it. I'm not just observing it. We were talking yesterday, Ashri Rupa Goswami says that when you're meditating on the activities of Krishna and the great devotees, you will actually feel the emotions of these great devotees. And he gives the example, you watch an ordinary theater, you feel the emotions of the character. And this is true with the great devotees when we're reading these pastimes. How did Lord Shiva feel when he was chanting these prayers? Anything he felt. And he wasn't describing something theoretical. What he's saying, what are some of the things he said? Can you remind me? Curly hair, what else? The bell, right? What else? His breathing, right? When he's breathing, the ripples, there's these three ripples that go in, expand, contract. What else? His nails, right? Effulgent nails. What else? The spirals in his navel, yes. And that the universe came out of it. It looks like the universe wants to go back. And he has shoulders like a lion. So Lord Shiva has actually seen Krishna many, many times. He's describing the person he loves. So how is he feeling?
How's he feeling? He's feeling in love.
So as we read these, we shouldn't be reading these just, you know, well, okay, I've done my Bhagavatam reading. And what's the result of this austerities? You know, the result of material austerities is you get just more entangled in materialistic life. You just amass more karma. Now, you might amass good karma, but you're still just amassing karma. But the result of these austerities is it breaks the karma bandhana. Why? Because it breaks our desire. Prabhupada said, we'll see the naked form of material desire. We'll see it for what it is. We'll see this is stupid. It's a facsimile. It's a dream. It's an illusion. It's not real. I mean, it's real that it's Krishna's energy, but it's not the reality. And we'll see, all I'm hurting is hurting myself. I'm just hurting myself over and over and over again. And we'll just go, no, I don't want to do that. I want to serve Krishna. And, as Lord Shiva was saying, all of your desires will be fulfilled. This is the irony. When we let go of our materialistic desires for overlordship, everything we wanted through those desires are fulfilled through Krishna. Whatever we wanted to enjoy, however we wanted to enjoy, Krishna is the soul that I saw. He's the essence of rasa. Akila rasa mitamurti. He is the form of all rasa. Any kind of rasa that we can want to enjoy, even ghastliness. Prabhupada talks about one class how he saw somebody slaughtering chickens in front of his son, in front of the slaughterer's son, and the son was very disturbed, but the person slaughtering the chickens was enjoying slaughtering the chickens and seeing them jump around without their heads. And Prabhupada said he was trying to enjoy ghastliness. And then he said, if you really want to enjoy ghastliness, who should you meditate on? Lord and Saint Day, Prabhupada said. That's pretty ghastly. You know, Prahlad Maharaj is describing him. He said, I don't fear your mane splattered with blood, your garland of intestines, your sharp wedge-like ears. Or what about Parasaram? I have one devotee Gurukuli friend who's really into Parasaram. Now, so even if you want to enjoy ghastliness, taking your axe, your battle axe, and cutting off everybody's heads. Or even like the story of Judd Barrett, where Kali jumps out of the deity and starts, she and her witches and hobgoblins start throwing around the dacoits' heads like balls and drinking the blood. Or Krishna and Balaram having that fight with Jarasandhar, and there were rivers of blood and there were pieces of animals floating in it. Some of you obviously are addicted to ghastly rasa. Some of you are going like, but my point is, even if you want to enjoy ghastliness, if you want to enjoy karuna rasa, like people go to movies, you know, to cry. Was it a good movie? Yeah, it was good. If you want to enjoy karuna rasa, there's the story of Lord Ramachandra. Lord Ramachandra is the deity of karuna rasa, lamentation. Anything, and any possible combination and permutation, and what to speak of all the vyavichari bhavs, they're all there, and then they're real. They're real, and we, the soul, are experiencing them. And Krishna is not envious of his servants. Krishna doesn't treat his servants poorly. In this world, people often do treat their servants quite poorly. But Krishna's not like that. Krishna has these liberations of like Sharsti, where he shares all his opulence with his servants. You have opulence equal to that of God. You can have a form, Swarupa, you can have a form equal to that. He's not envious.
I mean, even in this world, husband and wife, they share their bank account often. Right? If you love someone and they love you and you trust them, then you give them the keys to your house and you give them the passwords to your account, right? What's mine is yours, what's yours is mine. We often do this with our children. We're just conditioned souls. And Krishna's just, he's not, we're so afraid that somehow if I surrender to Krishna, I'll lose something. So if we do this austerity, this terrible, severe austerity of hearing and chanting about Krishna, we'll actually get a better result than doing all these other austerities. And we'll solve the real problem and we'll get the real solution. And then we'll feel all of my desires are fulfilled. Everything I could ever have wanted by taking any trouble for anything is fulfilled. Questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisement. Yes.
Thank you for the wonderful class. I love your points around the two effects that we don't want to go forward and want to go to the Krishna. I find that I'm still in the impersonal stage and I'm still struggling to deal with the fact that Krishna is a person. So how do I get over that intellectual kind of hurdle?
I lived in the ashram for 2 weeks before I figured out even intellectually that the devotees were saying that the impersonal rests on Krishna. And I remember reading Ravindasrupa Prabhu saying the same thing, that it was 2 weeks of being with the devotees before he realized they were saying that the personal was higher. It was just such a shock to me. It's probably coming from having been in some sort of impersonal understanding previously, yeah? Well, the four Kumaras got over it by smelling the tulsi leaves. The main way of getting over that, according to Srila Rupa Goswami, would be to go through the stage of Shantaras. Shantaras is your bridge. I mean, there are devotees in Shantaras, even in Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says that sometimes like the trees and the cows can be considered in Shantaras. And many of the residents of Vaikuntha are in Shantaras. But Shantaras is most often discussed about in relationship to Paramatma and to Narayana in general. And you might want to read about Shantaras in the Nectar Devotion, and you could go to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu also and read about the nature of Shantaras. And it is the main way that impersonalists start to become attracted to the personality of Godhead. So that might be a good beginning step. At least that's what's recommended by our acharyas. Anything else? Yes. Yes.
So how do we close the gap between our knowledge of Krishna and still that, sometimes that?
Well, sometimes we're aware of it. What it is that sometimes we become aware of it. When that devotee said that to me, I became aware of it. And I thought, wow, that's why I'm still a conditioned soul. So that answer is given by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita 12.9. So in 12.8 he says, you should just serve me with love, which Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says is Raganuga Sadhana. And then 12.9, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says is Vaidhi Sadhana. So Krishna talks about Abhyas Yoga. Abhyas means to practice, to repeat. And yoga means a connection. And Krishna is talking about a yoga of love, to practice love. And then he says, Icha, you will develop Icha, you will develop a desire. And that's what bridges that gap, because Vaidhi Bhakti is motivated by an intellectual, philosophical conviction, with some taste. Srila Rupa Goswami says, you can't even take up bhakti unless you have some taste. So there's some taste, there's some attraction. I'm sure you also have some attraction, or you wouldn't be sitting here. So we have some attraction. But the primary motivator is faith, intellectual faith, faith in Shastra, faith in Guru, logic. Or it could be fear, I don't want to take birth again, kind of thing. That's the main motivator. And the main motivator in Raganuga Sadhana is desire, attraction. I want to love Krishna, and I want to love Krishna in a particular, I want to love Krishna as his friend, I want to play with him in the fields. Or I want to love him as his parent and teach him or feed him things. Or I want to love Krishna as his beloved and dance with him in the forest and embrace him. And, you know, so there's different ways. Or I want to love him as a servant and I want to, you know, carry his buffalo horn for him in his lunch bag so he doesn't have to carry it himself when he's running into the forest. And that's what's driving that desire. So how do you, what's this bridge? Is by practicing. How do you practice love? So Prabhupada talks about that, you know, when he was growing up in India, that people were engaged to their spouse by the arrangement of their parents when they were still children. They didn't actually live together as husband and wife until they were mature, but they were told, you know, you're like 5 years old and you meet your 7-year-old husband. And Prabhupada said the families would get together and they'd say to the little girl, feed your husband some sweets. You know, they would have them practice love. If we think about, and that was Prabhupada's analogy that he would give, if we think about, like sometimes in a relationship, I mean, particularly perhaps in romantic relationships, but I think it can happen in other relationships as well, when there's been some loss of the initial love. And then if you go to a counselor, they'll often tell you how to practice love. How to do activities that are likely to rekindle that love. And there are certain activities that are more likely to bring out love than others. Like on Valentine's Day, they sell roses, not, you know, nuts and bolts. There are certain things that are more likely to help you practice love. So, you know, giving someone you love flowers both expresses love that's already there and helps to develop love. So what we're doing in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is we're doing the things that people who are Rigatmika devotees do. They offer Krishna incense, they offer Krishna flowers, they offer Krishna food, they talk about Krishna, they do various, that's what they do. But we're doing them more as a practice. With the idea, you know, Srila Rupa Goswami says, Anu Shilanam. Shilanam means activities. Activities, and he says, as of the body and the mind. And the idea is that our mind should follow our body. That when I'm offering flowers to Krishna, it shouldn't be just with my hand. And sometimes it's just with my hand, and then what does Krishna say in the 6th chapter? Pull your mind back. All right, it's Krishna in front of me. I should be offering with my emotion and not just with my hand. And we just practice that. And as we practice that, at a certain point, the desire actually starts to awaken. There's some desire in the beginning anyway, but it starts to awaken in a more mature form. Now Krishna says, if you can't even do that, then do Krishna Karmani, just do some work for me and eventually you'll become perfect. So if you can't even do sadhana, then give some donations, clean the floor, you know, help out in some way. And he says, if you can't even do that, then you should meditate or give in charity. But that is the entire purpose of Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is to develop that, to bridge that gap between philosophy, you know, to put it in modern terms, the head and the heart, to bridge the gap between philosophy and conviction and logic and our actual desire. so that we start finding that when we hear these things about Krishna, instead of this feeling of, it's a feeling of, and the austerities are showing us that we have this, because we may not think we do. We don't generally think that at our core, we're in deep rebellion against our greatest friend and benefactor. Who wants to admit that? I'm in deep hatred rebellion against my very best friend for absolutely no reason. I mean, who's going to say that? And that's what our austerities reveal to us. And as they reveal them to us, we go, huh. They simultaneously reveal to us how wonderful Krishna is and how foolish we are. And as they reveal them to us, we have the opportunity to change. We're not forced to change. We have the opportunity to change. We have the opportunity to say, I think I'm actually going to like you, and to feel this draw. I mean, wouldn't you like to see the person who has, you know, the coiled navels that the universe has come out of, and it looks like it's going to go back into again, and shoulders like a lion, and glittering Srivatsa, and Kastupa jewel, and curly hair. Wouldn't you want to see such a person? Wouldn't you want? So when this starts coming out, I'd like to be there. Then gradually, Prabhupada says gradually and proportionally, the rebellion starts becoming more and more uninteresting to us. And our fear and our protection of our false ego starts to melt. Right? Does that make sense? I'm just thinking, you know, sometimes people take care of animals who've been mistreated, and it takes a while for the animal to know, now I'm with somebody I can trust. And eventually you'll pet them, and they'll melt into you and accept you. So as we gradually learn, actually I can trust Krishna, he's wonderful. And my rebellion is doing nothing but causing me suffering. It has no benefits at all. Then that it dissipates. But it dissipates gradually. You know, as we do bhakti, we're still, even in Raghunuga Sadhana, that's still gradual, that's still not sadhya. That these are gradually melting and dissipating. Does that make sense? That's the idea. And if that's not happening, then we're not actually doing sadhana bhakti. Like Prabhupada says, when you're eating, you should feel satisfied. If you say, I'm eating, but I'm not feeling satisfied, he said, then you're not really eating. I think of it like chewing gum. You know, you're masticating and you're salivating, but you're not actually, there's no eating going on. He says, or you're actually eating, but there's some parasites that are taking all the nutrition. So if we think we're doing bhakti and we're not, our desires are not changing, and we're not starting to see things, then either we're not doing bhakti, or we're doing bhakti with some sort of offenses. And not doing bhakti is, I mean, one nice explanation is in Srimana Shiksha, verse 6, everybody's favorite verse of Mana Shiksha, the donkey urine bath, where you think you're getting clean, but actually you're bathing in donkey urine. So you think you're doing something that's bhakti, but you're not. It's something twisted, it just has that appearance. You know, or like, you know, Srirupa Goswami talks about the weeds packed up with the bhakti paper that look just like bhakti. So one should examine oneself. Prabhupada says you don't need a certificate from others, you can tell yourself, like you can tell whether or not you're eating. Are my desires changing? Am I getting more attached to Krishna? Do I even want to get more attached to Krishna? That's a good start. You follow? I'm getting the desire to have the desire. That's a good story. Is that all right? So I think we're out of time. Yes? So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jaya.